Welcome to this episode of Anesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Dr. Stefan Glaze, and I was the Dinwoody Simulation Fellow at the college last year, and I'm a resident doctor training in anaesthetics and intensive care medicine in the Thames Valley. Today, I'm really pleased to be joined by Professor Christina Diaz-Navarro and Dr. Ed Mellenby.
Oh, hello. I'm Christina. I'm an anaesthetist in Cardiff. I'm the academic head of the Department for Preoperative Care. I am a co-chair with Ed of the Simulation Advisory Group, and I'm also the chair of the Scientific Committee for the European Society for Simulation.
Hello, my name's Ed Mellenby. I'm a consultant anaesthetist in NHS Lothian in southeast Scotland, and I've been putting together a strategy for simulation for Scotland, which is how I got involved in all of this.
Yeah, it's great to have you both here today to talk more about the simulation-based education guidance that we collaborated lots on together. How did we end up here?
We all realised that anaesthetists have been leaders in the field of simulation, but there is still a variability of practice across the UK. It was clear to me that there were a lot of people designing and developing new simulation projects and reinventing the wheel at lots of different sites. And we really wanted to bring our expertise and our simulation community together and to look at what simulation activity should all residents expect during their training. And then once we've brought that together, we can use that information and that decision as a way of gaining further resources for what's needed, for sharing expertise at delivering those different types of simulation, and to bring the simulation community together over a common thought about what that should look like.
There are always local factors that affect that variability, but something that we could control was, in fact, to identify what areas of the curriculum were better represented through simulation and how that should be done, and building on the existing anaesthesia curriculum, just identify really what would be best served through simulation in a way that it is clear and it's achievable. And also, in terms of bringing everybody together, looking at what standards we are agreeing upon as a college and what we think should be prioritized. And I think that that's perhaps something important because we don't always consider simulation, what simulation is from the outside. Simulation practice has changed and evolved so very, very much. And in the beginning, I suppose, 20 years ago, we were thinking about simulation as a mannequin that did something. And then 15 years ago, we were thinking of a mannequin that did lots of things. And now we still think of simulation as using a mannequin to do something. And the mannequins are super important and very, very valuable. But there are many ways of doing simulation nowadays. We can use virtual approaches. We can use methods based on actors role playing. We can use endless new ways of exploring the area, and perhaps knowing that we've got such a range of techniques available, choosing what is most cost effective is a good priority to have, and probably is not emphasized enough.
Yeah, and there was a survey that we were really grateful to get lots of responses from around the country about what all the different schools were doing to deliver and coordinate training for anaesthetists through simulation. And it was amazing to see quite how varied the practice was. Lots of areas getting very frequent and regular simulation practice, other areas less so. And it's just trying to see how the college could support that and kind of get a more level playing field and certainly encourage development in areas, encourage knowledge sharing.
Having the opportunity to work on this document has been amazing, and it probably reflects quite nicely the way that I have evolved as a simulation practitioner, building on having done lots of simulation myself as an on-the-shop educator, and then sort of building up in terms of experience and expertise helps when a project like this comes together, actually try and make something really good of it and use all the skills that we all have.
Yeah, for me, I developed a strategy for Scotland, but then I realised that having a consensus view backed by the college, peer-reviewed by the college and its boards was so important. We need to take simulation away just from it's not just for the simulation enthusiasts, it's for everybody to experience, to understand and to work out, as you said, a level playing field of what people are looking for.
when we've set out these recommendations, what we proposed are some general principles of how simulation should be done. We recommend what modules should be done for residents, and we describe how those modules could look like. So that helps trainers inform the way that they set up their simulation experiences, but also residents have that reference guide to see how they can make best use of their simulation experiences. So the document in itself is not too long, is quite easy to read.
I suppose now's a good time to kind of drill down a bit more into what has actually ended up in the guidance. Lots of this work was informed by documents produced by ASPE, one of our kind of the national leaders in simulation. And they're a great organization because they cover the whole multidisciplinary team in terms of who's there on the board. And certainly, Christine, you've got some experience being on that board. What did you feel was kind of the key things that we need to mention in those general principles?
I think some of it is about using the most effective and efficient method of training that aligns with the needs of the participants. And I think, from seeing a lot of simulation activity across the UK, a lot of people think that it needs to be the most realistic or use the most high-tech equipment. But our principles that have come from ASPE are about aligning the technique with the requirements of the participants and actually trying to choose the most efficient and effective means to do that. Means that sometimes it's about using lower levels of reality or lower levels of fidelity to achieve what's required. And sometimes that's the best way forward. It's not trying to make things too complex, it's trying to make them achievable and more efficient and effective.
I completely agree. And also, I think that something that is important is that in the document, we've wanted to allow for creativity. Not everything has to be done the same way. It might follow a standard, but it doesn't mean it's the same. So we've made it very clear that simulation can take place ad hoc when people set up simulation experiences in working environments. It can be in situ, it can be in a trolley, it can be in different ways. But also, it's important to have specific training days that are outlined and that the residents get protected time for. So by highlighting that both ways are all right, it encourages individuals to be creative in the way that they use their local resources. But the one thing that we are not compromising on is that we do recommend that those delivering simulation should have appropriate training. I think that faculty development in simulation is essential. I think that setting up a learning experience for the residents that is safe and that is useful and that allows them to reflect and themselves find those new insights that are so important in us growing as professionals. That's not easy to do, and it needs to be supported by some form of official training. So people should be trained to be able to train others.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, this novice course that I help coordinate, and we were facing the challenge of kind of a few extra delegates wanting to come and learn. And we really kind of looked closely at the simulation we were providing and realized that, we were doing quite high fidelity simulations quite early in the course. And it, limited the numbers that could attend on the initial welcome day. And it also kind of potentially wasn't psychologically safe. It was quite a challenging simulation for someone who hadn't necessarily spent that long in the operating theatre environment. And so we kind of broke it down into what, we took a step back and looked at the learning outcomes and what are we actually trying to teach? And that really helped us to revisit those and kind of redesign and think about the course in a different way, which had the added bonus of meaning we could have more candidates and people coming along to the course, and meant that we got more learners through for a similar price in terms of what the deanery had to support.
That is super important, Stefan. What you've just said is so crucial. If you know what the learning objectives are, then the simulation will facilitate learning those learning objectives. And it's so easy to add superficial things to the simulation that don't really add to the intended learning. And similarly, it's so easy that the debrief will go away from the learning objectives. So this that you have just exemplified is at the core of what good simulation looks like.
We mentioned a bit about faculty. What have you seen kind of change in the way of faculty development over the past few years in simulation?
I think there is a greater effort across all four nations in providing faculty training opportunities for simulation educators. Here in Wales, we have a faculty development program that commenced two or three years ago. They run it five times a year, and it's free for anyone working in Wales, within NHS or within universities. And that just didn't happen before. And it is a multi-professional course as well, which I think is super important because we work in teams and we should learn in teams. NHSE in England has set up lots of resources and courses for faculty development. They've been working on this for a long time and they're very, very good at what they do.
Yeah, I actually managed to attend one of their trial workshops recently, so they're certainly expanding that, and it's a really good e-learning package that they've produced that's kind of freely available to anyone who's got e-learning for health access.
Exactly. And Scotland is doing really well as well, isn't it, Ed?
Yeah, there's a number of faculty development courses going on across Scotland. We're hoping that the guidance document highlights the importance of that process. It's about making sure that those faculty development elements are available and people know where that they can attend to get the training that they need for the type of simulation they're running. Yeah, it's massively important. And it probably makes more of a difference that the trained faculty make far more of a difference than the equipment that you've got. One important thing that I found is about developing your faculty within the programs that you're running. So actually having ongoing faculty development where you review how you're teaching and training during the courses that you are running. It shouldn't be just seen as a one-off event that you go to a faculty development day and then you're trained and you're ready to go and you don't need to look at your ongoing professional development anymore. We need to provide opportunities within the simulation training that people are running where they review their practice, trying to continually improve and quality assure the simulation that they're running.
And not only that, you need to develop your faculty for what they are going to do. So, if you are going to have a faculty group that are going to be developing courses, they need to learn about course design. But if they are not going to develop courses, if they're going to follow a course that is pre-designed or a program that is pre-designed, then what you want to emphasize is probably facilitation and debriefing skills. So, I think that if you've got any control over what your faculty are trained in, the more adjusted it is to what you're going to do, the better. However, I do fully agree with Ed. I don't think that your training is a one course and then you're done. I think that we continue learning forever. I mean, I was doing a recording with my colleagues in Wales last week, and we were talking about debriefing, and I was saying you've got good days and bad days, and you try your best, you gain your skills, and you get better at it. But it doesn't mean that you're the finished product. We continue working at it every time, and we keep learning every time from each experience. And I think that that's crucial, really, to our development, not just as simulationists, also as anaesthetists, isn't it? This sort of continuous reflective practice, and if possible, shared reflective practice goes a long way in making us a little bit better every day.
The other part of the document's focuses a bit more kind of on some details about how the curriculum could be supported by simulation. Did you have any thoughts kind of as trainers in your region how you think this is going to be used well by people? Have you heard of any instances if it's been kind of supporting people already?
Well, the document that we wrote with you, Stefan, was really crucial at that moment. It was necessary, but it is not the only thing that is needed. So we are working very closely, firstly, with the anesthetic community that do simulation. We're asking them, what do you need? And precisely, they ask for this, for quality assurance and for support on quality assurance. So this is something that we're doing now at the national level.
I mean, so Ed, for you, what does quality assurance look like in the simulation setting?
For me, the most important thing is the principles behind it, is that the faculty have the best interest of the residents or whoever the participants are at heart, and they're continually trying to improve the simulation activity that they're doing. That it's aligned, as we talked about before, the simulation activity is aligned with the intended learning for those participants, and that we have a process of review of that activity. Does it align? Does it meet the ASPE standards? And are we evaluating feedback in order to improve the course as it goes? And for me, those kind of self-correcting mechanisms are the most important. If I'm trying to support a simulation project, the most important thing for me to see in that is that the team that are running it are looking to qu constantly improve the quality of it over time and have that kind of self-correcting mechanism where they are working on feedback. And they're the most important principles to me.
For me, quality assurance is a very simple concept. It's about aligning with the standards and it's about evaluating. So very much what you have just said, Ed. And in terms of aligning with the standards, we need to align with not just with the simulation standards, but also with the professional standards of all participants. And that's something that does require some thinking when you are designing a simulation experience of some sort. The ASPE standards, the 2023 version, is something that is very close to my heart because I was the lead author of that document, which was done in a consultative manner, trying to identify how best to support the UK community and also evidence-based. And I think that that's a relatively easy to read document for a standards document. And I think that it gives a good idea of what sort of values we should try and preserve, more important nowadays than ever, given the strange political world that we live in, and how we should train our trainers, what's important for simulation educators and technicians to be prepared for, and SPs, simulated participants as well, have got their own set of standards. How the activity should be prepared and run and evaluated, and how simulation facilities and simulation groups should organize themselves and should be run. So I think that that gives you a really good idea of you know what is expected of good simulation practice. But I think that not everybody is inclined to be reading standards documents, and that's fair enough. That's why we as a simulation advisory group at the college, we are taking on the task of making it easy to get it right through all of these documents and tools and resources that we will prepare and provide.
Right, yeah. There's nothing like having, sometimes you just need a kind of a slightly awkward question there to make you think about what you're doing and question yourself. If you don't have those kind of people who come to your courses and question what you're doing and, question your teaching, then sometimes you just need an external person to help with that in the, kind of soul searching questions.
That's a very interesting point. You said an awkward questionnaire. I think that sometimes our questionnaires are indeed awkward, and they don't need to be. I think that the most sensible the questionnaire is, the most useful it is. Because if the question seems obvious, the answer should also be obvious. And if we are not meeting the obvious answer, then we need to do something about it. So getting the words right in the tools that we use and making them as easy to understand and as easy to use as possible goes a long way to getting them used well.
Could I jump back to your previous question, Stefan? I've definitely found that using that guidance document to help justify resources and funding has been massively helpful and help released funding to run courses at a national level for me. And I think that's because having a there is something important about having the Royal College of Anaesthetists stamp on that document that says this isn't just me thinking this course needs to be run. This is the college saying it needs to be run. This is a recommendation of how it should be run. This is a recommendation of how it aligns with the curriculum, and that there is a clear need for this type of training. And I found that hugely helpful to help release funding, help kind of. Kind of bring people together over that course and give people a shared understanding.
Yeah, likewise. The as a resident, you can looking at these modules that we developed, you could see as I progress through training, you can see where each of the different kind of tricky points in training come up. Stage two, lots of things to cover and learn, and how actually simulation could really support kind of getting over those steep learning curves in the subspecialties, if well designed and readily available kind of courses that fit in with our curriculum are there. But that's where we kind of need to get this collaboration going so that good work that's happening across the country can be shared.
When we think about simulation, we're not only thinking about anesthetic training, we're thinking about training of teams, which is very important. But also, we have to start thinking that the non-pedagogical uses of simulation are becoming more and more common. So, to use simulation to assess processes rather than assess individual performances, or to innovate and design, or to test a new setup, or to test a new protocol, or even is starting to be used for therapy. So simulation is now being used to treat patients in different forms, to treat pain, to treat anxiety. to treat the trauma of being in intensive care, in a bed and awake and not enjoying any sunshine. So, it really is starting to be used that way, as well as in a more scientific way. There is a lot of simulation in the planning of surgical treatment, for instance, So I think that there is the field is widening, and with regard to how simulation is used. And without a doubt, depending on how it is used, there will be different, not just different theories supporting the correct use for that purpose, but also there will be maybe the need of identifying what good looks like for those uses, because what we have been talking about is really most of the time for education and training. But when we're starting to use simulation for other purposes, it's not quite so clear how it should be used and how it should be quality assured. So for me, that is super interesting and super exciting. I also want to say that perhaps it's easy to forget that, we're not alone. This is a very, very big world. And these challenges that we have been discussing today are similar to challenges faced everywhere. So I think that one of the very important things that we need to do as a simulation community is, in fact, be in touch with what other groups do in other countries and how they solve problems. For instance, in the Netherlands, they are having a lot of trouble recruiting staff, nursing staff in particular. And the government has invested millions into a new program to shorten training time through the use of simulation. So it will be, I'm really interested in seeing what they are doing and what's happening and how that's helping, because it might be that some of the solutions are useful for us in this country. I think that there is so much good work going on all around, and I think that keeping our eyes open to what other people have to offer and keeping learning from each other is amazing. Likewise, I think that here in the UK, we're actually quite sorted with regard to wanting to do things well and wanting to be fair with others and wanting to be equitable in access. And I think that this is also something that we should take away and exemplify for others. Not only we're talking about what simulation is for anesthetists and for our teams, we're thinking, how does this practice evolve internationally, and what can we do together to make things better quicker?
Yeah, and certainly as a resident, now the kind of the dust has settled on the new curriculum, this kind of document I think helps schools look at what learning they're offering and how they can help trainees to make the most of the clinical experiences they know they can provide, you know. So for some people listening, hearing that there are more opportunities for simulation will get them excited. And for some people, they will be daunted by that because they've had a bad experience of simulation in the past. Chris or Ed, have you got any ideas or comments on how to approach those two different kind of opposing views?
I'd say for people who want to get involved in simulation, want to run a local course, then use the network, use the advisory group, and there will be somebody near you who's running a program similar. So get in touch with them and find out what they're doing, and get involved in that network, and you will find the community of simulation enthusiasts are really welcoming, really want to see good quality simulation. And as we said before, it doesn't have to be high fidelity. You don't need all the kit in the world. The main thing is that you have experience as faculty, and understand what you're trying to achieve, and are using the resources and the people around you to improve.
Very interested in the second scenario that you've proposed, Stefan, the one in which someone has had a negative experience in simulation. There are so many ways in which that can happen. I think that some of those difficult experiences in simulation are due to triggers, due to reminders of previous situations that haven't been quite so positive, or sometimes reminders of family situations that are not great. It's really, really difficult, really, to control what, well, impossible to control how people are going to feel when they're doing simulation. We know that we can try and create a psychologically safe environment as much as possible, but that does not guarantee that people will feel psychologically safe. I think that learning to develop, establish, maintain psychological safety is a crucial skill in all simulation practitioners. But I would go further than that. I would say that this skill is not just for simulation, it's for life. And I think that we need to work in psychologically safe environments. We need to support each other, and we need to be attentive that we don't all perceive reality in the same way, and that variation in interpretation of life and in how things affect us really does impact the way that we perform at work. So I would say perhaps simulation can help us achieve these life skills that will make us not just better at our work as healthcare professionals, but better colleagues towards our colleagues. And I think that that's super important. So I think that if you're not interested in simulation, you might be interested in this other thing. And if you're interested in this other thing, come and meet the simulationists, like I was saying, because we tend to think about all of this. It really is a value-based practice, what we do in simulation. And I think that that's quite transferable to anything else.
Yeah, you certainly described something that makes simulation such an enjoyable thing to help facilitate and teach, in that, it is a lived experience, and that has a really powerful impact on people in terms of how they learn, and hopefully it's for the positive, but certainly it can be for the negative, and it can even take a long time to kind of unpick negative experiences.
There are new fields of research and development with regard to how we get it right more of the time. Learning how to manage these experiences in a positive way is something that simulation can help with, and it's something that us as simulation practitioners endeavor to do at all times.
Yeah, I think I'd agree that the real reward of simulation and gaining those skills of simulation faculty is nurturing environments where people feel able to speak up and share their frames, share their experience and knowledge and challenges. And when you can create that in a simulation environment, there's a lot of that transfers and spills over into real clinical situations. And a lot of people find that's one of the main benefits and rewards from getting involved in simulation.
I think we're coming up to the end of our time together. I just wondered if there are any kind of key takeaway points that you wanted people listening to the podcast to go away and think about, or go away and do differently.
I would just say it's a really exciting time for us to engage with the simulation network and community, both within anesthesia and more widely, as Chris has said, to improve access to simulation training, improve quality of simulation training, and make a real difference to patients.
I would like to say that if any of our audience are interested in what we are talking about, they should just join us either through the network or through the events that we run regularly. And we are also starting a new partnership with ASPE, and we are starting to make use of their educational events.
Thank you so much, Ed and Christina, for a really great conversation.
Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you.
And thanks to you for listening. We'll have more information and useful links in the episode description. For more podcasts like this, make sure you subscribe to Anesthesia on Air, and you can apparently review us while you're there.